Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 800. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about snowmobiling, snowshoeing, dog sledding, flight seeing, the Aurora Borealis, and moose as we go to Alaska in winter. Welcome, the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about Alaska. I'd like to welcome back to the show Sherry Ott from ottsworld.com, who's come to talk to us again about Alaska. Sherry has been on the show talking about Alaska before, but we're going to go to Alaska in winter. Sherry, welcome back to Amateur Traveler.
Thank you for having me back and talking about one of my favorite places in the world, winter or summer.
And Sherry has been on the show many times talking about many places. I don't think I will try and come up with all of them right now, but I'll put a link to some of them in the show notes. Sherry, you had to talk me into doing this show. Let's just get this on the table. It's cold in the wintertime. You could go someplace warm. Why should someone go to Alaska in the winter?
There's so many reasons, but let me hit a few. Aurora, so Northern Lights.
Okay.
Definitely. Dog sledding in the Iditarod. And then I would say fewer crowds. It's unique. Not many people go in the winter. And so you feel like you have it really to yourself, this big, vast state. Those are some of the reasons I really love it in the winter. It's less touristy. I connect more with the locals, mm-hmm. and I see how they live in the winter, which I think one of the most fascinating things about going to Alaska in the summer or winter is meeting the locals and seeing how they live in this great frontier, because it's quite different than the rest of the United States. And so I think you even get that more intensely in the winter.
And I'm assuming with the size of Alaska that a one-week itinerary is easy to see everything we need to see in Alaska, right?
Oh, my goodness. One of the unique things about Alaska in the winter, if you think about it, is it's easier actually in a way to get around, or it becomes larger in a way to get around, because all of the rivers are frozen. And okay. From, I think, one of the other episodes we talked about Alaska on, we talked about all these really remote places that you have to fly to that mm-hmm. don't have roads that connect them. Well, in the winter, you can get there because you've got snow machines and frozen rivers and all this kind of stuff. So in some way, it becomes even more vast in the winter. But yes, it is still a lot to cover in the winter, even if you stick really between Fairbanks and Anchorage, which are probably the two kind of hot areas to go to in the winter. There's still a vast amount.
And we use the word hot in a very ironic fashion at this point. Okay.
Yes. Well, and all I can say is do not let the cold scare you, because okay. honestly, I was just there in March again.
With a group?
Yes, with a group. I was doing a group tour for my Ottsworld followers or mm-hmm. audience. And in March, it's really not too crazy. Most of the days in Anchorage, at least, it was right around the freezing 32 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
Fairbanks is a little bit of a different story, but it never really got below zero Fahrenheit in Fairbanks. So that's kind of March weather, I would say. February, you're going to definitely have days below zero in Fairbanks, probably more like negative 15, stuff like that. But the whole thing is you have the right gear. you work with the right tour operators, and it really isn't a big deal. It's part of the adventure for me, I guess. So, and that's one of the cool things is a lot of the tour companies that you can use will provide really great gear for you. Like, you don't have to invest in really expensive stuff all the time. So that's another thing to just kind of note, if that's one of the things that might be stopping you from going in the winter. But I personally think it's worth it. There's so much to do there. It's so fun.
Well, what kind of itinerary are you going to recommend for us?
I'm going to recommend one that is probably a little bit adventure forward, I would say.
I would be surprised if you did not.
Yeah. But I'm also going to recommend one that gives you the maximum chances to see the Northern Lights.
Okay.
So in that case, I would probably start in Fairbanks.
Okay.
Because Fairbanks is really the place. Every night you're there, you want to try to get out and look for the Northern Lights, because of course, the only way you're going to see them is by being outside. So every night you want to try to maximize that. And the best place to see them is in around Fairbanks. And the reason why that is it's right on the Aurora Oval.
Right on the Aurora Oval. Okay.
Yes. Oh, don't get me to talk about science. But there is an actual oval where the Aurora tends to always show up. Okay. And as the Earth rotates, there's all these apps and stuff where you can see right when like Fairbanks starts coming into the oval as the Earth rotates. But also places like Iceland and Norway and these kind of places are on that oval too. But the reason why Fairbanks is so great is because it is landlocked, really. So there is no bodies of water, big bodies of water close to Fairbanks. It's really, they call it the interior. And that means that it's much colder and much clearer skies. And you need clear skies to be able to see the aurora. And so places like Iceland or maybe Norway on the coast and stuff, they tend to be a little bit cloudier because of the moisture from the water. So the best way to see aurora is probably some of the coldest places in the world.
Okay.
But it's clear. So aurora in Fairbanks for sure. And there are a number of different ways to see it. There's so many different ways. In fact, more and more companies are offering multiple offerings. So things to do while you wait for the aurora, like ice fishing, dog sledding at night, which is actually super fun. The dog sledding at night is actually kind of magical. The white snow, when I was just there, we did it, and it was a full moon the night we did it too, which was really cool. But yeah, so ice fishing, snowshoeing, even snowmobiling. So all these different outfitters are starting to offer multiple things. So you can do something while you're waiting for the aurora. And then if it comes out, you can stop and take pictures and so on. And that makes it kind of nice because the aurora in Fairbanks or in Alaska comes out kind of late.
Okay.
Normally, anytime from 10 to about 3 in the morning. I actually often talk about chasing aurora in Alaska as kind of like going to Las Vegas clubbing. Because you kind of have the same, time frames of you're going out late, staying up all night, getting back at 3 in the morning and sleeping most of the morning. And you have a little bit different time frame. But if you want to see the aurora, that's how you do it. You got to make some of those sacrifices. So I would probably start in Fairbanks and start off right away with setting up a couple of aurora tours.
Okay.
There's a couple that I love. Absolutely love. One is from Aurora Bear, which is just a couple, Frank and Miriam. They're actually from Germany originally. He's a wildlife photographer and Aurora photographer, and they live off grid about 45 minutes out of Fairbanks. And you go and spend the evening at their house. They make dinner. They've got dogs. You can snowshoe. Frank can teach you everything about Aurora photography. And it's just a very small, intimate experience. It's great. You learn about living off grid. You learn about what made them come there. You name it.
And when you say they have dogs, I'm interpreting that as being sled dogs.
No.
No, just cute puppies.
They've got four lovely dogs. Okay. Yep. I don't think those dogs would pull a sled.
Okay.
But they're lovely. They will go out and snowshoe with you and so on and so forth. And he's got just a really beautiful setup. It's super dark and they're in all these woods and it's really pretty when the aurora does come out. So they're one that I would definitely do. Another one, a new offering that they had, which is it's very economical, I would say, is a place called Aurora Point, which you can drive out there yourself. It's a brand new, kind of like a big barn in a way, set up specifically for waiting for the aurora. They've got games. They've got fresh cookies and drinks, and you all sit around and someone else is outside waiting for the aurora. And if it comes out, they'll let you know. So it's kind of like the easy way, but it's simple. And it's, I want to say it's only about like $40 or something like that to go stay at Aurora Point. And they're open from like 10 to 2 in the morning. And you have to have a reservation. But that's kind of one of the new ways. They'll also take some pictures of you with the aurora if it comes out. That's a really cool, easy way to get out and stay awake. And then another one that I did just recently, which was way more than just the aurora, and I would recommend for anyone wanting to do something kind of unusual. It's a day tour from Northern Alaska Tour Company. And they actually, I flew up from Fairbanks. I flew up to a place called Coldfoot, which is above the Arctic Circle. It's right at the beginning of the Brooks Range. So a beautiful flight. You get to see everything from above, the Yukon River, the Yukon Flats, the beginning of the Brooks Range. It's gorgeous. You land in this tiny little truck stop town. You have lunch there. You learn about life in Coldfoot, which is quite a unique place. We talked about it on my summer podcast when we talked about Alaska in the summer.
Right.
And then you get in a van and you drive back down the Dalton Highway, stopping at the Arctic Circle, stopping at different other points to talk about the pipeline and so on. And then at night, you stop at the Yukon River to have dinner. And then you get deposited at about 11 o'clock at night at this beautiful little old historic like trapper's cabin. And there you can stay and then watch for aurora. And then at about 2:30 in the morning, they'll bring you back home another hour and a half. It is an all day, all night trip, but it is packed full of landscape, culture. Like you learn so much about Alaska and the people there. And then hopefully you get to see aurora. It's a nice setup.
Very cool. Yeah. No, we also talked about Coldfoot on the episode we did about a year ago on the driving the Dalton Highway. Not that you and I talked about, but
yeah. But yes, well, it is kind of the stop. It's the middle halfway stop on the Dalton Highway. And I think it's like 18 people actually live there. So Northern Alaska Tour Company offers a number of different packages. That's the one that I did. But you can also actually fly up there and stay in the winter overnight and watch for aurora up there and do stuff in the Brooks Range and so on. But they are a well-oiled machine. I've never seen logistics run so well for a tour company. I mean, I have to kudos to them. And I think for me, it made it really special because that night when we were driving back and we stopped at the trapper's cabin, that was the best aurora I saw. It was amazing, dancing and colors, and it was really exciting. So there's a few ways to see the aurora from Fairbanks. During the day in Fairbanks, there's a lot of different things you can do also.
Or at least during the afternoon when you're awake.
Yeah, after you've slept in and had a late breakfast or brunch. I always like to include things like walking with reindeers. You can actually also do that in the summer, but there's a couple of different places now that offer that where they offer you a chance, because reindeers are domesticated animals, actually.
They're not naturally occurring in Alaska, are they?
No, I believe they were brought over.
Okay, that was what I was remembering.
Yeah. Okay. So there are a few places that have reindeer herds, well, small herds, very small herds, but it's a chance for you to learn all about them. And it's actually, you wouldn't believe how much trivia you can learn on reindeer. Really? Then you can actually walk around. They're a herd animal and they always have kind of a leader. And so they walk the leader out and then the rest of the herd will follow and you can just walk right with them. And then, of course, do some picture opportunities and so on. But it's really kind of a really unique educational couple of hours, I would say. Also, once again, learning about Alaska at the same time.
Will they let you join in the reindeer games? Because I understand that those are sometimes people get excluded from that. So.
Yes, yes. I did not ask. But
did you have a particular outfitter or whatever that you recommend for that?
I normally go with Running Reindeer Ranch.
Okay.
I know. And yeah, it's funny because I probably went the first time there with Jane is the one who started that, probably went about 6 years ago, but they've really exploded. So they're quite busy now, busy enough that another reindeer operator has also opened up. And I think, I can't remember what that operator is called now. It's also just on the outskirts of Fairbanks and they do the same thing. So if Running Reindeer Ranch is filled up, there's other options too. Got also, it. At the university, because the University of Alaska is there in Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
They have a great museum that I would definitely recommend to go to. But they also have, I think it's called a large animal center or something like that. But they've got muskox, reindeer, probably even caribou, a bunch of different of the winter animals out that you can also go and see and learn about through the university.
Okay.
So a few different options there. What else? Ooh, one of the cool things that I did a couple of really new cool things on this last trip. I went snowshoeing, which that's great, but I did this snowshoeing with a company called Leaf Out. And I shouldn't even say company. It's a woman who runs tours. So once again, very small, intimate experience. She moved out there about 11 years ago, and she lives in a little cabin by herself. And she is a naturalist and does forestry work for the state, basically.
Okay.
And she runs snowshoeing tours in the winter in her woods in her backyard, which is massive, massive. And you will learn so much about the winter and the forests and the animals. It's a really great way to go snowshoeing. I mean, I love snowshoeing just for the activity and the views. But it's inevitable when you're out there, you see animal tracks or you see something and you're like, I wonder what that is or I wonder why that is. And she'll have an answer for you. So like we did play a little game of guess that scat.
As one does.
And I have to admit, I did pretty well. But no, I mean, you learn about all the habits of the animals in the winter, mm-hmm. what their different footprints look like, directions that they're going. So you're kind of really learning about even how to track animals in the wilderness, all the remnants of the pine cones and stuff that the squirrels have saved to get to the pine nuts all winter. And it's really, really interesting, as well as you'll learn about the boreal forest and the permafrost and why the trees grow the way they do, because they look really scrawny and small, but they're actually can be upwards of like 75 years old, but maybe only like 3 feet high. So she is fascinating to learn all kinds of stuff about nature and snowshoe at the same time. And she makes some really wonderful herbal tea. But once again, this is a small experience. So if you're traveling independently or have a very small group, she is a great person to get in touch with. And she works during the day. So she's doing this on the weekends and during the evenings. So it's something you would want to book in advance for sure.
Okay.
Another really cool thing that I did this time that was new was I went to the Fairbanks Curling Center.
Okay.
Yeah. When you think of these northern countries or states, that's what they do in the winter as a pastime, in addition to dog sledding. They're at the curling rinks. And Fairbanks has a really big organization. And I went there to talk to the manager and see what they offer. So one, you can just go and watch. There's a bar. Okay. Like if you want to find a good local bar, go to the curling club. There's a bar there. They have like a whole viewing area where you can look out over the ice and watch. I think personally, that would just be a fun place to go for a drink. But they also, the curling club occasionally will offer some tour groups a learn to curl session. So it's a few hours. They actually get you out onto the ice. You learn all about how the game is played. And then you actually get to, I guess they call it throw a stone, get to actually do the sweeping and do a few rounds. Your group gets to do that. And it's fun. It's really fun.
And what are the odds that I will fall down? That's really what I picture.
Yeah, pretty good on the first time or two, to be honest. Yeah, they also, though, they do have, I was noticing, if you are not the type of person that's flexible enough to get, because the curling stand, it's kind of like, it's good to be, you know, have some yoga background a little bit, because when you take off and you throw the stone, you're kind of in a lunging position and you're sliding.
Okay.
And so if you don't feel like you can do that, they also have these like little poles where you can actually stand and the pole connects to the stone and you can actually just kind of guide it and let it go that way too. So you don't have to do the full on lunge.
Got it.
But it's a really unique cultural thing to do that I think many Alaskans also do. And also it's just important in the North, basically. So that was a really fun little afternoon thing you can do before going to see the aurora. Yeah. And then I would say there's also things like snowmobiling tours, some really good outfits there. One funny thing was this last time I went, I think it was called Rod's Alaskan Guide Service. And I went to the website and it looked like one dude, like just being a guide. And so I drive out there to go snowmobiling And it wasn't one dude. It was like a major operation. But it was a very well-run operation, let me tell you that. But it was just funny. There's a bunch of stuff in there. You can also do dog sledding and so on. And let's talk a little bit about dog sledding, because there's a lot of different variations. You can do that in Fairbanks. We're also going to talk about a place you can do it in Denali and some other places in Talkeetna down the way. But I think you have to decide if you want to ride, if you just want to ride in the sled and go on a dog sledding ride, or if you want to mush your own team, because they're two very different experiences and very different price points for that matter.
And you pay more to
mush your
to
own
mush.
Team. Okay. Yes, definitely. Because it takes a lot more time, more time. And there's more risk, I suppose, also. But if you just want to ride, there are tons of places that you can go and ride. You can, like I said, you can go at night. One of my favorite ones is the Last Frontier Mushing Co-op.
Okay.
It's a group of people that have their own dogs and live off grid. They're young people, like, I don't know, 20s, 30s, probably. And they use their dogs to get around normally, but they also come together as a group, as a co-op, and then offer tours and so on to people in the winter, which is really cool. And you learn about the kennel, and you also can learn about, they all race normally too. Many of them, I think a couple of them have run the Yukon Quest, but they do shorter like sprint races. So you can learn about all of that too, but then they will harness up the dogs, get the sleds ready. You get in the sled, they cover you up with all kinds of blankets, and off you go for a fun ride for about normally not more than 40 minutes for most tours. So that's certainly one way you can get a taste of it. And the first time I ever went, that's how I did it. But if you're like me and you want more, you want more control, maybe, you might be interested in mushing your own team. And that's a whole different experience. And there are a number of places also that offer that. Last Frontier used to, they are not this year.
Okay.
But I think it kind of depends a little bit on the moose activity and some of the risks involved.
And I'm trying to parse that sentence. It depends on the moose activity and the risk involved. So you're out there with the wild moose, and if there's too many moose, they don't want novice mushers.
Yes. And it's a danger to people and the dogs. And I will say everyone this year when I went in 2022, moose activity was really high this year in Alaska. I had a run-in with a moose that was not fun. But because there's so much snow, they got more snow than normal. The snow is really high and it's hard for the moose to get around, as well as it's covered up a lot of the
foliage.
Yeah, that they would normally eat. So they are being forced to come in more to the trails where it's already packed down and they can get around easier and get to the willow bark. And so that is leaving more human moose encounters or dog.
And the moose are grumpier because it's harder.
They're hungry and it's harder. And they say, I was told that it's going to be a really hard moose year. Like many won't survive or they won't have as many that survive.
Got it.
So even like when we did our night mushing at Last Frontier, they had a snowmobile go out ahead on the trails, like a good 15 minutes before us, and kind of just flush the trails to potentially scare any moose off.
Discourage any moose from,
Yeah. So they're really good about it. I mean, they, it's safe and that's really nice. But the mushing your own team, or like they'll call it a mushing school or something like that, that normally entails, anywhere you go, will normally entail, they're going to outfit you completely. So you're going to stay warm, and they've got the best, I mean, the best stuff. Oh, they have these things called bunny boots that look like these white giant military boots, but they are the warmest things I've ever been in. And they'll give you parkas and big mittens and everything. And you learn how to actually harness the dogs. You put the dogs on harness and hook them all up to your team, to your sleigh. And then you get instructions on how to, because you think, oh, all you do is just stand back there. But no, it is not just standing. There's a lot of things you need to know back there. And it's about balance, and especially going around turns and being able to control the dog's directions by voice commands. So, and lots of places will normally only give you about 3 or 4 dogs to run with when you're first learning, as opposed to like when you see like the races and stuff, they'll have, I think, 13 or something.
And more dogs is faster and harder to control.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Much faster. Yeah. So when you're learning, it's great to only, I think the first time I did it, I had 3 dogs. Okay. And yeah, I mean, and you're balancing on one side of the sled at times and certain places. And at times you have to get off and run and help, like up hills, which is so hard. So it is really an athletic, it's a sport without a doubt. So for people that are interested in that and getting a little bit more hands-on, the only thing I would say, the only downside to it is that once you do it, you'll never want to just ride in a sled again, ever.
I just have this mental image of Sherry Ott, who can't hear about Mongolia without deciding to drive there, that can't learn to mush without wanting to join the Iditarod. So,
yeah. Yeah, it is. It's fun and it's addicting. And yeah. But so you have a little bit of something for everyone. Or you can also just, whether this is in Fairbanks or some of the other places, you can also just visit a kennel if you don't want to do either. So it's kind of different levels for everyone, I suppose. And the kennel visits, you really kind of learn about the Iditarod and dog racing and what it takes to run a kennel, especially like financial, because it's really expensive. And how to take care of the dogs and so on and so forth. And then you can walk around and meet the dogs. And the nice thing is in March, you have a pretty good chance of seeing puppies, which is really exciting. Like little puppies, like a few weeks old. So that's always kind of fun. We saw some at one of the kennels we went to in Talkeetna. And it was definitely a highlight being able to hang out with the sled dog puppies.
Very cool.
ButcherBox is sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler, and I just got my first ButcherBox. I've got packed with dry ice came 4 packets of ground beef, 3 packets of chicken breasts, 2 steaks, some pork ribs, and some sirloin tips. Now, I've got a great recipe for what to do with the chicken. At least one of those packets of chicken is going to become Greek chicken and rice. And if you go to chris2x.com, I've got a recipe there that's an Instant Pot recipe. But I'm not good with steak, and so I'm going to take advantage of the fact that ButcherBox has recipes on their site at butcherbox.com to learn some great recipes to do with those steaks. You can have ButcherBox deliver meat to your doorstep. Free shipping as always, curated to custom box plans. You can easily find high-quality meat and seafood you can trust. 100% grass beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. I also like the fact that I could recycle all the box and shipping material that they sent. Sign up at butcherbox.com/traveler and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off. Choose salmon, chicken, breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/traveler. If you got recipes for ribs or steaks, send them my way as I send my thanks to ButcherBox.com for sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So that's some of Fairbanks. I mean, there's plenty to do during the afternoons, plenty to do at night to watch for the aurora. You can go really far remote up north and cross the Arctic Circle, everything. Then after, I would probably spend about, I know we try to spend about 3 days there total, or 3 nights, I should say, and each night out looking for aurora for sure, and then supplementing with some of these other activities.
Well, and I know that when I was in the Yukon, they were talking about that if you go for one night, that your chance of seeing the aurora is, you know, I don't remember what it was, 50-50 or something like that. But three, it starts to get up to like 90%.
You're right.
So there's another reason why you go for 3 nights.
Yes, exactly. And that is, you're exactly right on those numbers. It's 3 nights, and I think it's up to like 80 or 85% in Fairbanks.
Okay. Which still means you have a chance that you won't see it.
Yes. It's like wildlife. There's no 100% guarantee. You cannot control it.
Right.
You can look at all the apps, and you can have a wonderful KP index, which is tells you the probability of seeing them. You can have a super high KP index, but if for some unknown reason clouds come in where you're at, you're not going to see it. a little bit of luck, but you can increase your odds by staying there.
Okay.
And that doesn't mean that you can't see the aurora south of Fairbanks. I've certainly seen it all the way. I've seen it in Anchorage. So we'll talk about that. But I always like to start in Fairbanks so you kind of get your best chances up front. Okay. And then I still say every night you should go out and look for it if you can. If you can keep those hours, basically.
Right.
The next thing that I would say is start going south. And there's a few different ways you can do that. So you can take the Alaska Railroad, which is actually runs in the winter. And it's really one of my favorite things to do because it's really unique. You've taken the Alaska Railroad before, right?
No, I haven't been north of Juneau in Alaska.
Oh, my goodness, Chris. Well, the Alaska Railroad's really unique. It's the only, I think, state-owned railroad we have that runs passengers. In the summer, they've got a ton of different routes and beautiful sightseeing. In the winter, originally, it was just they just run between Anchorage and Fairbanks, really for the locals. And then as winter tourism has started to pick up, there's been more and more interest in tourists riding the train.
Okay.
So they still in the winter just run it between Fairbanks and Anchorage, but they make the stops in Healy, which is in Denali National Park, and they make a stop in Talkeetna, which is a famous little small town. And then I think they have one other stop in Palmer and then down to Anchorage. The only thing is they don't run every day. So if you want to make the Alaska Railroad part of your itinerary, your winter itinerary, you have to really look closely at their schedules. And their schedules change from February to March because March, the tourism kind of starts to pick up because you have better chances of seeing the aurora the closer to the equinox you get. And they run it more frequently. I think it's like maybe even 3 days a week in March. But in February, it might only be once a week. So you just have to pay attention there. If you don't want to drive, you can take the railroad. You're probably going to take it all the way down to Anchorage or maybe stop in Talkeetna for a night. But then you're going to have to figure out how to get from Talkeetna to Anchorage by car, probably, because it's not going to run frequently enough. Since it doesn't run every day, you can't just catch the train again and go down to Anchorage. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend taking the train if you can, if that works into your schedule. It's really a fun thing to do. Also, I should note that there are a few tour companies that, like up in Fairbanks, that will drive you down to Denali and you can go snowshoeing in the park. And then you catch the train at the stop there in Healy, basically. And then you can take the train back to Fairbanks.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So there are a few outfitters that are doing things around the wonky train schedule so you can still try to fit in a train segment. So it is sort of possible. If you don't take the train, that means you're driving and you're driving the Parks Highway and driving in Alaska in the winter. You have to be comfortable with it, I would say.
Right.
You never know what's going to happen.
And prepared. Yeah.
Yes. And one nice thing is you can rent cars that have, it's more, but you can rent cars that have studs on their tires and stuff like that. I've done that before in bad weather there and I feel much better about it. But so it just kind of depends on your comfort level there. But I know my tour, we had a driver and a van. And so we drove. And one of the things that I would highly recommend is stopping in Denali. It's different in the winter. Mm-hmm. The park road isn't fully open in the winter. It's only open back to the visitor center. Okay. But at the visitor center, they used to have free snowshoes that you could just go in and get and then and then snowshoe around on different trails. They gave you a trail map and so on. And then you just bring back the snowshoes and the poles at the end, which is kind of unique for a national park. So there's that kind of stuff that you can do there. It's also just a beautiful drive down the Parks Highway in general between Fairbanks and Anchorage. But if you can, I would highly recommend staying overnight in Healy. There's a couple of hotels that are open and going. My favorite dog mushing of all times is a company called Moon Dog Kennels. And it's actually by Earth Song Lodge. It's a dual venture. Anyway, they do expedition dog sledding if you'd like. Or once again, you can go visit the kennel. You can go learn how to mush. You can go take a ride. Or you can actually go on an expedition.
So expedition meaning multiple night trip.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. And I told you, I drank the Kool-Aid once I got on the sled and I learned how to mush. Then I'm like, I want an expedition.
So surprised.
But for people that want to do that, it's really cool because they'll take you out. You can mush your own team. I think that time I had 8 dogs. We were going much faster. Huh. And mush your own team out to a dry cabin, remote cabin, uh-huh. on a lake, on a frozen lake. And then we stayed over in the cabin with a guide and the dogs. They would let, I think, 5 dogs in at a time. It was awesome. They slept with us. It was so fun. If you're a dog lover, oh my God, this is like the best thing ever. They treat their dogs really, really well there. And they're the only company with a license that can run dogs in the park. And okay. you have to run dogs in the park because they don't allow you to run big vehicles in the park. So they do something where I think they go out and they do drops with a dog sled team. They do drops for climbers for the spring, wow. for people who are going to climb, because they can't do the drops with a regular vehicle because it's not allowed. So they have to do it by dog sled.
Hmm.
So that's not something open to tourists, but you will learn all about right, it right. when you go on that tour, which is really interesting. So anyway, and then the Aurora viewing, and you can go like 30 miles with dogs the next day, mushing your own team, which is pretty cool. So they're just a really great stop. And then I would probably go down to Talkeetna. Talkeetna, like I said, is a small little town. I know we talked about it for some of the summer trips. It is considered the gateway to Denali. I'm not really sure why, because it's still another hour at least to get there. But you have mm-hmm. Beautiful views of Denali, the mountain, actually, the mountain. Mm-hmm. when it's clear. In addition, that's where all of the climbing expeditions take off from. There's a ranger station there that okay. you can also visit. There's little museums there that you can visit. It's really cute. They've got a brewery, a wonderful pizza place. In the winter, lots of great snowshoeing. Talkeetna is actually, I think it stands for like Three Rivers or something. It's where three rivers meet. And you can actually stand out on the river or go snowshoeing out on the river and watch for Aurora. It's also the place where all of the flight seeing takes off from for Denali. Oh, okay. So that's probably why it's most important to tourists. So if you want to do flight seeing in Denali, over Denali Park, you always are going to take off from Talkeetna. And fun little fact, in the winter, you have more clear days than in the summer.
Hmm.
And the flights are way more likely to actually run.
Okay.
Because the flights are all weather dependent. So every time I've gone to Talkeetna in the winter, which has now been 3 times, our flight has run, which is really nice. My group had really beautiful sightings of Denali. You can also, in March, they start doing glacier landings. So they will fly you out from Talkeetna into Denali National Park, land on a glacier, let you walk around the glacier, get back on the airplane, and fly back.
And I was going to say, and this is landing in a fixed-wing plane, not landing in a helicopter.
Yes, fixed-wing plane. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
I have done that, not in Alaska, but just over the border in the Yukon, and it is... Mm-hmm. the smoothest landing I've ever had in a plane, because you're landing on snow. And I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting that. It
yeah.
was a fascinating experience. And it doesn't, even when you can fly, it doesn't mean you can land.
Yes,
you
right.
have to have
it's
the right, and, yeah, you have yeah. to have the right conditions. And so there's a, in that area, there's a relatively small number of people who've been able to do it. Like mm-hmm. when I was there, I think it was 100 people had been able to land on the glacier. But if you get that opportunity, it's pretty darn cool.
Yeah. And I think, like I said, I think the flight seeing companies start doing the glacier landings normally mid to late March and into April is when those become possible. Otherwise, we just did a regular flight seeing thing around right. all the mountains, the Denali Range.
And honestly, the landing is really awesome, but the flight seeing itself is the amazing part. So it'd be yeah. great if you could land, but even if you can't, it's just stunning scenery.
Yeah.
And I wasn't there in winter, which would be even a whole different level of things.
Yeah. You feel like you can just reach out and touch the mountains, like they're that close. It's pretty epic. So yeah, so that's actually a really good reason to stay over sometimes at night in Talkeetna. And we did that. We stayed at little cabins in Talkeetna. And then, like I said, at that night, we walked out to the frozen river and tried to wait for the Aurora. It did not come out for us that night, sadly, but we still had a good time. And they've got some really great, strangely, they've got some really great bakeries in Talkeetna. If you go, I definitely say stop at the Talkeetna Roadhouse. It's wonderful. And a little place called the Pink Squirrel or the Flying Squirrel. Now I can't remember. Something Squirrel. also a really great bakery.
One thing we should talk about a little bit is you talk about bakeries and Roadhouse and such. My impression is, and I haven't spent that much time outside of a ship in Alaska, that Alaska is more expensive in terms of just buying food, for instance.
It is. I will say that. Like, for example, up in Fairbanks, because I spend a number of nights up there.
Right.
Any time I went out to dinner or even breakfast, well, let's see, dinner was always going to be around $19 for anything, any kind of entry or entree. That was pretty standard. Breakfasts were going to be upwards of $15.
Although these days I can't go anywhere without paying that much money.
Well, you're in California though, too.
That's not too bad.
Another thing, though, that's kind of weird about Fairbanks in particular is it has an immense number of Thai and Asian restaurants.
Of course.
It's a town of 30,000 people, but they must have, I think they said they have like 30 Thai restaurants. And they're good. They're really good. But like pad Thai will cost you $19, just to give you an idea, I guess. But it's good food. That's why I also recommend, I like to state when I'm up in Fairbanks in particular, they often have like lots of little apartments for rent, like apartment hotels kind of thing. And I stayed in one of those this time called Sophie Suites. That way I had my own kitchen and I made breakfast and I made a lunch there every day. And I would just kind of go out for dinner and I could also bring leftovers back. And that was a really great way for me to save money.
Right. Sure.
And I think they have a lot of those because of all of the workers that come into town seasonally. So there's a lot of those kind of operations like suites. So Talkeetna. Now we're down only a couple of hours from Anchorage. Mm-hmm. So then driving down the rest of the way to Anchorage, there's a bunch of different stops you can make there too. There's a muskox farm that's really fascinating.
They are an amazing creature.
Aren't they? They look prehistoric.
They're an improbable creature, I guess.
But the cool thing that I didn't know about the muskox is that they're farmed or they're raised for their hair.
I could see that.
Kibbeit, I think is what it's called. And it's some of the warmest. It's like, I don't know. I'm going to guess. It's like 5 to 10 times warmer than merino wool, their hair.
Okay.
So they're raising all these muskox. It's in Palmer, actually, the muskox farm, to basically get their hair. And then they sell that. They sell the yarn and stuff like that. It's really, they process it and sell it. It's cool. It's really interesting to learn about muskox. It's an animal that most people have never seen nor know anything about.
No, and they're just kind of a ball of fur.
Yeah.
They're made for very northern climates. This is really far south for them in the wild.
That's true. So that's a kind of a cool stop to make. Mm-hmm. Then let's base ourselves down in Anchorage. There is so much to do out of Anchorage in the winter. There's certainly dog sledding, snowshoeing. There's specific snowshoe companies. You can do helicopter to snowshoe on a glacier and that kind of stuff. But some of my favorite things there in and around Anchorage, I would say, is Aurora. There's a really great Aurora tour. Carl from Alaska Photo Treks will take you out. And he is an expert at finding where to go around Anchorage to see the Aurora.
Okay.
He'll only run the tour, obviously, if there's a good chance of seeing it, if he knows where to find it. But he'll take you out all night in a very comfortable van. It's warm. He has snacks and hot chocolate. He will take pictures of you in front of the Aurora. It's a great operation. So I would set up a night to do that and see how that goes. The snowshoeing there. So Anchorage is surrounded by the Chugach mountain range and just like not even a 20-minute drive, you can be out to the mountains from downtown, really. And there's some snowshoeing operations that run there. You could also rent your own snowshoes and go, but I always find it way more interesting to go with a guide. You learn more about them and the culture, and you don't have to worry about bears in the winter, which is nice, but you do have to worry about moose.
Oh, that's right. They're asleep.
Yes. Yes.
But the moose are hangry, so okay.
Speaking of the hangry moose, there is a coastal trail around Anchorage that it gets a lot of billing in the summer because, of course, you can rent bikes and go out and it's beautiful. It goes all around the inlet and you get some of the best views of Anchorage.
Okay.
But you can also do it in the winter. It is groomed and those bike rental places turn into fat tire bike rental places in the winter. And I rented from a place called Pablo's, which is awesome. They had really high quality bikes. They were electric fat bikes and they had studded tires. So you are biking on the snow, but I felt very comfortable the whole time until I encountered the moose.
But that was another story. So the moose you encountered was while fat tire biking in Anchorage.
In Anchorage, in the city. And they say, strangely, and I'd heard stories about that before, like if you want to see a moose, just go out on the Tony Knowles Coastal Trail and you'll see moose. Hmm. And sure enough, I did. I came around a corner and I literally just like hit the brakes. The moose was in the trail and I stood there and I'm like, I don't know what to do. There was a little bit of a scare there, but I know better next time. But anyway, you will see moose on that trail most likely. Hmm. But there are also a ton of people out walking on the trail and so on. So it's well traveled, I would say. You will not be alone. But that was the first time I'd actually ridden on it. And I was stunned at the views. It was really pretty. Some other things in and around Anchorage. I took this time a glacier tour. There's a couple of big glaciers that you can get to from Anchorage very easily. Okay. One is the Matanuska Glacier. And the Matanuska Glacier is, I think, one of the only glaciers you can get to or see from the road system, maybe in the world. I don't even know, but it's up there in that. Like, I'll never forget the first time I saw it. It's along the Glen Highway, which is probably one of my most favorite drives I've ever taken anywhere. Scenic drive through the mountains. And all of a sudden, I remember looking off to my right, glancing and going, wait a minute, glancing again. And there's a glacier right there. Like, it's weird. Normally you're not going to see anything that close to a road system.
I'm going to say not in the world because I think of the Athabasca Glacier off of the Columbia Iceway in Banff National Park.
Oh, you could be
which
right.
Which is a little further off the road than it used to be. It used to be right next to the road. It's receding, but it's really right off the Columbia Iceway.
Yeah. Well, this is one of those like that then. I don't think very there's cool. not a lot. Normally to go to a glacier, you've got to go
I thought of the one in Juneau, but of course Juneau, even though it's the capital of Alaska, is not connected to the rest of Alaska by road. So like, oh yeah, you can drive there, but you can't drive anywhere else. So,
well, and even though the drive is beautiful there, I would suggest my recommendation is take a day tour from Anchorage. Mm-hmm. I went with Salmonberry Tours. And you start in Anchorage, they drive you out there, which is awesome because then you can actually just enjoy the scenery and not have to worry about driving on that road.
Sure.
Which is wonderful. And they make stops so you can take photos. Like I said, the views are stunning. And they'll drive you right to the glacier. They provide the crampons and the hiking poles and snacks. And you spend a couple of hours out hiking on the glacier, which is really wonderful. Picture opportunities, obviously learn about it. One of our guides was a geology major and so on. So he had so much to share. It was really cool. Hmm. And then afterwards, you stop at a little local restaurant just right by the glacier, actually, to have lunch and overlook the glacier. So it's a really fun full day trip, but very scenic, a little bit of activity in between. And it's really memorable. And then if you want to take it up one notch on the glacier viewing, you can go south down to Girdwood. And from Girdwood, you can then do a half-day snow machine or snowmobile tour to the Spencer Glacier.
Okay.
My only caveat there is if you've never, ever ridden a snowmobile before, it might not be your thing because it's a good 10 to 15 miles, I want to say, to get to the glacier on the snowmobile.
Okay.
And then back. So it's a lot of, it's serious snowmobiling.
Well, and for those of us who live in California and don't have ready access to snowmobiles, it is a rough ride?
No. Well,
cold ride? What am I going to, what do I need to know?
Rough is in, that's a good question. So they will say it's an ungroomed trail. So an ungroomed trail means that it's going to be a little bit more bumpier.
Sure.
You're not breaking new snow. I mean, there is a trail there. It's just not groomed nice and flat and smooth, basically. So it is going to be a little bit rougher in a way. Also, it's going to mean that it's probably a little bit slower because it's slightly more technical. Not technical because you're going up and down big things or going around sharp turns. It's more technical just because you have lots of little dips and you just have to kind of be aware. It just so happened that when we went this last month, we went in like, it was snowing like crazy, which made it also the visibility a little hard if you were not used to that.
Got it.
It's a little white out. So.
And everyone in your group or half the people in your group are driving the snowmobile. So you're not.
Yes. Okay. Yes, you are driving your own snowmobile.
Yeah. Okay.
That's why I'm saying if you're not comfortable with like or riding on ATVs or stuff like that, then it might be a little bit long for your first snowmobile.
Makes sense.
Adventure. Okay. But if you are ready for something like that, it is amazing. There are some straightaways too, where you can go really fast if you want, but then the rest is kind of slow going, but you then snowmobile out to the Spencer Glacier. And normally like in the summer, cause I visited the Spencer Glacier in the summer too, and kayaked around it. Cause there's a whole like lake basically that it comes into and you can kayak around it. But of course they never let you get close to the face of a glacier because it's very dangerous.
Right. Ice comes off. Yes.
But in the winter, it's all frozen. So that lake is completely frozen and you can walk up and touch the face of that glacier, which is pretty cool. That's what makes that one to me really unique, because having been there in the summer and seeing it in the summer is really cool. But once you kind of get off the trail in your snowmobile and you hit that frozen lake, it's amazing because there's also icebergs that are like frozen into the lake in the winter that you go around. And then you take your snowmobiles right up to the face of that glacier, you park them, and then you have about an hour to walk around and explore. You need to be with a guide, obviously.
I look forward to seeing your pictures of this.
Oh, it's cool.
Yeah.
The guides go out every day and they know the changes because glaciers are still moving even in the winter.
Right, sure.
So you need to be safe. That's a really unique tour. It's a long tour. It's physical, I suppose, in the sense of snowmobiles aren't like cars that you just get in and you put it in drive and have power steering. They take a little work.
Okay.
But that's really a fun day. Another thing while you're down in Girdwood, which is just, Girdwood is a 40-minute drive from Anchorage down the Seward Highway. Beautiful. You see the Turnagain Arm. It's beautiful scenery. But you stop in Girdwood, and that's where the big ski hill is called Alyeska. And so you could ski there for sure, or you can just take the gondola up and have lunch up at the top and watch the skiers and take the gondola down, which is really pretty. There's snowshoeing around there at the base. They also have a number of fat tire biking trails and snowshoe trails around there at the base. And the resort, the Alyeska Resort's just really kind of beautiful. It's a fun place to go check out. They've got a spa. They've got good restaurants and stuff like that. But the little town of Girdwood is one of my favorites too. It's cute. Cute breweries, good little restaurants, that type of stuff. So lots of stuff to do down there. There's also a wildlife center down there if you want to stop. And that's open in the winter also. Obviously, depending on the time of year, depends on what kind of animals you're going to see. But lots to do down there, basically.
I feel like we're winding down on our itinerary here.
Yes. I mean, because I would normally, like if you have a week, most people have a week, right? I would start in Fairbanks for 3 days, go down, spend a day in Denali doing the dog mushing and the snowshoeing, probably a night in Talkeetna, try for flight seeing, and then enjoy the little town of Talkeetna, and then down to Anchorage, base yourself there, and do a couple of excursions from there to the glaciers. So you get a little bit of everything. That way, I mean, you really get all the epic things that you can do in Alaska in a week. Glaciers, dogs, aurora,
moose.
Snowmobiling, moose. And then, of course, in between, there's always museums. There's the Native Heritage Center. All that stuff is still open in the winter. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit different sometimes in the winter, but it's still open and good. And before you know it, your week is gone. And hopefully you've seen the aurora about 5 times.
Right. And had some good pet time. So
yeah, that would be my recommendation. And then I think there are a few other things that you could plan things around, such as the Iditarod. The Iditarod is run in the first weekend in March, I believe. It was the 50th anniversary this year, which was pretty exciting. And there are a number of tours that are planned around the Iditarod. So people can go specifically and watch the ceremonial start. They can watch the real start. They can be taken out in the middle of the race somewhere and watch the mushers go by or something like that. I have not done that personally, but I know that there's a lot of offerings around that. And you visit kennels. It's obviously a dog mushing focus.
Okay.
So there's stuff like that. Up in Fairbanks in February, starting in like mid-February, is the World Ice Carving Festival, which is really pretty cool. It's amazing. I couldn't believe how big the sculptures were. It was pretty amazing. They put them off like on in the woods and then light them at night. It's really pretty. So you can go and obviously during the festival and watch them create, which I think would be really cool. At this time, I went during March when they were all already sculpted and I just went around and looked at them. But the ice park is open where you can do that. So those are some of the things. And then there's also, of course, the Yukon Quest, which either ends or begins in Fairbanks, depending on the year. I can't remember the exact date of that off the top of my head, though. That must be February.
February 19th was this year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so more like mid-February, probably. So you could go around that.
I did not realize that went to Fairbanks. I feel ignorant here. Okay.
Oh, no. But they share. What I like about that one is it switches every year, right? It either starts in the Yukon, ends in Fairbanks, or vice versa.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So whereas the Iditarod always starts in... actually technically Willow, Alaska, which is a little bit outside of Anchorage, and finishes always in Nome.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I think both of those times would be kind of a neat time, like festival times to go. And then of course, with the Iditarod starting around Anchorage has a big, I think it's called the Ferrandi Festival, which is a big, and they have snow carvings and all kinds of stuff going on outdoors in Anchorage in the beginning of March. So that's also a fun time to be there. And then the other thing I would just mention as far as timing is if your goal is Aurora, it is true that your odds are better the closer you get to the equinox. So the closer you get to March 21st.
Okay.
But with that also, it gets busier. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know all the science behind it, but I've been told and historically it is more active around those times. Same thing goes on September 21st.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you can also see their aurora season in Fairbanks runs, they say, from, I think it's like end of August to end of April. Because basically that's when it still gets dark and you can see it. March is a good time to go. However, the other thing I would say about Alaska winter tourism is it is getting more and more and more popular all the time.
Sure.
It's interesting. It's a tour industry there that's kind of in their infancy, I would say, for winter, but they are ramping up fast. And so there are more and more offerings all the time happening. Every year I go, there's more stuff. But also there, I think with COVID and the fact that this is domestic for Americans and exotic, they are very popular right now. Summer is going to be booked, but even winters are popular.
But it had been getting more popular before COVID too, so that's not too surprising.
They have kind of picked up where they left off. I was asking them about tourism numbers and they are breaking records every year over year.
Interesting.
So get there now.
Sherry, as we start to wrap this up, you're standing in the prettiest spot. Are you just standing under the aurora someplace? But if I say you're standing in the prettiest spot, where are you standing? What are you looking at?
In the winter, I'm definitely looking up. Yeah.
Okay.
I am at, I think it's called Slate Lake in Denali National Park. And this is where, when I talked about the 2-day dog sledding expedition I did with Moondog Kennels, probably one of my best 5 travel days ever was that expedition.
That's saying something. Okay.
Being in that little cabin so remotely, and then the aurora came out and we ran out to the middle of the lake on the ice and looked up and it danced like I had never seen it dance before. It just moved across the sky. It's something to see when it's really, really active. And the more you go, and obviously the more nights you're out, the better chance you have at it really dancing and being active.
And one thing that makes you laugh and say, only in Alaska in the winter.
There's lots of things, but the first thing that came to mind was the fact that there's a moose in the middle of the town in Anchorage.
That's one of the first thing that came to my mind also.
Like right downtown.
Sherry, if we're going to send people to Ott's World, to your best post on... Alaska in the winter, where are we sending them?
Oh, man. I can't pick one. I've got to pick two because I have one that's like, I think it's 20 things to do in Anchorage in summer or winter.
Okay.
And then I have another one about using Fairbanks as your home base for winter travel.
Okay.
And both of those will have a lot of what I talked about.
Well, I just realized since we started recording, this is the 800th episode. So you get two. You get a bonus here for being on episode 800 of Amateur Traveler.
I feel so special.
And Sherry has more tours coming up to Alaska. So if you want to learn more about what she is doing, you can join one of her two newsletter lists. Yeah. You've got a regular newsletter I know that I'm subscribed to, as well as a tour newsletter.
Yes. So I have something called the Otts World Tour newsletter, where they're the first people to know of when a
new
tour is open. This Alaska tour, which I basically kind of took you through. All these places that I talked about are places we're going to on our week-long tour, starting in Fairbanks, ending in Anchorage next year in 2023. So the people on that newsletter will be the first to know when it's available, which is going to be here really soon. Okay. And then as a side note, I'm also trying to make it, that's a group tour in which I will be there and facilitating, but we'll have a group leader. But I'm also trying to take that type of itinerary that we just talked about that has more local interaction and intimate tours and make it so that you can book it as an independent trip too. So it might have a little bit different look, but it'll same kind of idea. So like if you're a teacher and you can't do the trip when I'm going to be doing it, there are ways that you could do a similar itinerary.
Excellent.
So that'll also be announced in the Otts World Tour newsletter.
Sherry Ott, thanks so much for coming back on Amateur Traveler. I'm glad it happened to work out to be someone that I have known for years coming on the 800th episode. I didn't even think about that when we started recording. So
I have a question, though. Have I at all convinced you, who loves warm vacations, that you should go to Alaska in the winter?
My wife and her college roommates want to go see the aurora, so I may have to send them this episode. So,
Yes, absolutely. Okay, that didn't tell me that you wanted to go, though.
No, of course not. There was the eat cookies and play games while somebody comes and tells you the aurora is ready for you. Thank you very much.
Nice. Well, okay, I'll still work on you yet.
And thanks so much for coming back on Amateur Traveler.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I love it.
These special episodes, when I hit a round number like 800 that I never, ever thought that I would hit the almost 17 years ago when I started this show, are a good time for me to remember and celebrate, but I don't celebrate them with a special episode in the sense of a different format. I celebrate them by doing what I always do, and I thank the patrons of the show who support the Amateur Traveler in the current form that it is. Anybody who makes a podcast or anybody who makes something creatively knows that they find people that enjoy it and are willing to support it, and other people who it's not their cup of tea. And I understand that, so I appreciate those who do. If you're interested in supporting Amateur Traveler, you can go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler and get an ad-free version of the show, as well as some other stuff, so check that out. There are still a couple of slots open to travel with me to Turkey in September of 2022, unless you're listening to this after 2022, in which case you missed the opportunity. But you can always find the next trip by going to amateurtraveler.com/trips and joining that private Facebook group where we decide where to go. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. I thank you for being with me on this journey, even if this is your first episode, and especially if this is your 800th episode. If you have any comments, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so, so much for listening.